Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So what we're going to discuss, what we're going to think together through, is the question of meaning, or negatively stated, the problem of meaninglessness. Now, it's with this problem that the question becomes most acute, usually in our lives. Often we just coast along through life until we meet the problem of meaninglessness. Now, this problem often presents itself in various forms that we're familiar with. When we suffer something like depression or a lesser evil, malaise, or when we suffer something like anxiety or a lesser evil, ennui. When we meet physical suffering. Also, we experience this problem when we're found in the chaos and confusion of life. The contemporary world is in many respects overwhelming, and the overwhelming character of it in some sense causes us to freeze before it. We can't adjudicate between all of the meanings that are bearing down upon us. Then also we live in a culture that is to a large degree fragmented. It's moving through a transitory phase. Irish culture and Western culture as a whole is moving through a great transition. And with any large transition, society becomes somewhat chaotic. And we see this in political society at the moment and the various chaotic character of that in regions throughout the West. I remember when I went through university, graduated from here 27 years ago, that my life at that time was very confusing and chaotic. And I found it really disorienting to try and reorient myself. Now, what I hope to do with you tonight is not argue for the meaningfulness of reality, but rather present to you my understanding of its meaningfulness, steeped in the Catholic intellectual tradition. The philosophical tradition that grew under the wing of Catholic theology. And a primary point of contact, this is the Thomistic Institute, would be St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, to do so, we have to set up the problem in a somewhat philosophical way. Now, the way we do best is we think through the 20th century philosophical developments. Many of you will be familiar with the fact that existentialism grew to great strength in the 20th century. This was partly precipitated by things in philosophy itself, and it was compounded by the suffering of the 20th century. First, the First Great World War, World War I, and then followed by this, the Second World War, and the many regional wars since then. Now, because of this, existentialism grew through the course of time. We live life in an existentially biting way, and because of this, this philosophical development grows deeper and deeper. Now, there are many good movements in existentialism, but two problematic movements, the first nihilism and the second absurdism, have really taken over thought in the European continent and to some degree also in the Anglophone world, England, Ireland, Australia, and predominantly the USA. Now, we might not recognize the significance of that immediately, but if I put before you a thought, you might then take it as significant. Culture is like the intellectual air we breathe. So we're here breathing oxygen, the air that surrounds us. Now, intellectually, the air of the intellect is culture. Culture is communicated to us through all kinds of media, and we pick up the culture of our society and its milieu, and this is the air that we breathe. So no matter how clearly you think, no matter how precisely you think, you're in this, what I would describe as polluted air. The air is to a degree polluted because of these two movements, nihilism and absurdism. So let's look at them both briefly. What is nihilism? It comes from the Latin nihilo, which means nothing. So it's an understanding of reality that divests reality of all meaning. Reality is meaningless. Now, this grew in the French intellectual tradition throughout the 20th century, in this historical period. Now, following upon nihilism is absurdism. Because nihilism is so difficult to bear if you try and live it out fully, like really realities without any meaning, you have to impose meaning upon things. That's a very difficult thing to do. Because of this, a philosopher, Albert Camus, suggested that we have to live in the face of the absurd. Ultimately, reality doesn't give itself to us, doesn't show itself to us, doesn't give its intelligibility or its desirability, but we have to live passionately in the face of the absurd. And this is what it means to live with authenticity. Now, what you find in these three movements of thought is that you as an individual have to impose your meaning on reality. You have to, so to speak, create meaning out of yourself. And you have to give it to the world. And in doing so, you have to chart the course of your life, having constructed it out of yourself. Now, that's a philosophical description. But let's see its impact. Because that has infused contemporary culture, this air we breathe. And because we breathe this air, we then approach reality somewhat affected by these currents of thought. These currents of thought are in each one of us. Now, this presents a problem. This presents a problem because why get out of bed in the morning if, in fact, reality is meaningless? Why do anything whatsoever if, in fact, reality is meaningless? If it ultimately has no meaning, and indeed, if it proximately, right here and now, has no meaning, there's no reason to do anything. Now, it seems to me that these philosophical currents are self-defeating. You can't actually live them out. But many of us live in a confused way, partly thinking like this, and partly discovering meaning, and partly imposing meaning. And because of that, we have a hodgepodge experience of life. Life is chaotic in our experience, and consequently confusing. Now, all this does is compound human suffering. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm not going to argue that reality is meaningful, but I'm going to present to you its meaningfulness, and then I'm going to ask you to see if it resonates with you. And then in the question and answer session, we can do some arguing if you want. But it seems to me fruitless at the beginning to do so. It will be needlessly philosophically complex, and therefore we should just get into the meat and go straight to meaning. The intellectual tradition of the West thinks that reality makes sense. Now, this might seem obvious, but given these philosophical trends, it's not obvious in our experience. But the world makes sense. Now, this is proven at every moment of life. Ask yourself this question. Is there anything you've ever encountered that you couldn't to some degree understand? That you couldn't to some degree discover as good? When you discover something to be understandable, when you discover something to be desirable, that is to be good, then you recognize that this thing before you has meaning in itself and for you. Now, this is proven at all moments of life, notwithstanding the confusion that we sometimes find ourselves in when we go down strange paths and discover that we meet something absurd or something nonsensical. Western tradition proposes this sense to us, that the world is wonderfully embedded with an incredible density of meaning. The world has a logic to it. All things in themselves and all things in relation to another. And that we, as human beings, we as rational individuals, can explore that meaningfulness. We can, so to speak, read from reality its inner structure. And when we read from reality its inner structure in this way, it draws us to itself. Now, this is all that we mean by knowing. Indeed, this is how we define the intellect. The intellect is intus legere, to read from within. And so when we come to reality, we discover that it is intelligible. We can read its meaning from it. And this reading of meaning from it then coordinates our relation to it. And this is incredibly wonderful. Now, because we take it for granted, we don't often recognize how wonderful this is. Indeed, everything we take for granted follows upon taking this for granted. At every moment that you are awake and aware, at every moment that you encounter anything whatsoever, it gives its meaningfulness to you. And because it's so seamless in our experience, except when we meet complex problems at university, because it's ordinarily so seamless in our experience, we utterly take it for granted. But this basic human capacity is wondrous. Without this capacity, we'd be isolated in ourselves as individuals, have no contact with reality, have no relationality with anything whatsoever. So we ought to step back for a moment and wonder again at the fact that we're set in relation to all things, and all things are manifesting to us their glorious, wondrous meaning, and all we have to do is to attend to them. All we have to do is focus the intellect, focus the mind upon the reality. And the intellect is a power, and it is powerful. In fact, it is arguably, and I think St. Thomas might agree, the most powerful faculty. Now, as a power, that means if it's applied attentively with focus, it powerfully unveils what it's attending to. Now, it doesn't matter whether your IQ is really high or whether your IQ is really low, your intellect is still a power. And if you look at something long enough, it will give itself to you. Now, this differentiates IQ from wisdom. To be wise is to look deeply into things. To be a fool is to look at things superficially. But even the simple intellectually can be wise because they can attend to things, apply their power to things, and allow things to give their meaning. And again, this is wonderful. We can see something of its wonder if we bring before us a metaphor. Light and sight are often given as intellectual metaphors. So think of the wonderfulness of color. I actually looked at this auditorium earlier and all of the seats are colored differently. I thought that's interesting. It makes the space more interesting. What would life be without color? What would our experience of reality be if everything was grayscaled? Indeed, that's often the experience of someone who's anxious and depressed. It's like life, the world within which they are, loses all of its vivid and vibrant relief, and it takes on this black and white or grayscale character. They see things still, but they can't really enter into their vivid character, their vibrant character. Now think about this in relation to the intellect, a greater power than sight. It must attend to the world, and when it does, the world gives itself. Now the main ways we attend to the world is just by being awake and aware, not allowing the distractions of life to zone us out, to overwhelm us, but rather being capable of a kind of attentiveness that capacitates you to be present to where you are, to what's before you, most importantly, to who's before you, and allow it to give itself. And if you do, you experience its meaningfulness more. Now you'll notice this readily in children. Children have not lost their wonder at knowing. Children have not lost their wonder at their encounter with reality. Children are struck by awe before everything. And in doing so, they attempt to grapple with it. They want to understand it and they want to articulate it. We have a 2.5-year-old, a little more than 2.5. And he takes great joy at the moment, just pointing at things and naming them. Daddy, cow. Daddy, truck. And you're like, okay, I've taken that for granted. But for him, it's like, wow, these things I've come to know. And not only know them, I can kind of understand them. And I can understand to such a degree that I can name them. And this is an amazing thing. This is joy. Now, as we move through life, we tend to leave that kind of wonder and its corresponding joy behind. But this is actually the native character of the human being. To be struck in awe before what is wondrous. And out of this being struck in awe before what is wondrous, there arise three questions. What, who, and why? What am I? What is the world and the things of the world? Who am I? Who are you? And why? Where have we come from and where are we going? Now, these questions, they burn in the human heart. Indeed, because of these questions, I'd wager you're all at university. To be at university is to seek universal knowledge, to seek the knowledge that encompasses reality. You might be in a particular discipline, studying that in a focused and disciplined way, but really you're attempting to attain a universal understanding. You're doing so, I would wager, because these questions in some way burn. What is everything? Who am I? Who are you? And why is everything? Now, if we fail to wonder before reality, because we take things for granted, these burning questions will tend to become more and more muted. Their volume will, so to speak, be turned down. And in consequence of this turning down of volume, we will experience meaninglessness, and with it a kind of listlessness, and with it perhaps even depression and anxiety. Meaning is really something that lies before us as the nourishment of our souls, as the nourishment of what it means to be human, what it means to be a spirit. Let's take another metaphor to understand that. When each of us came into reality, we came into reality as a unicellular organism, and we had a path of bodily development through time to reach maturation. And most of us here now are at the peak of maturation. I'm on the downslope. Most of you are still on the upslope. Now, what does the body have to do to develop and mature? It has to encounter reality. First, it has to engage with the world. The body has to move and engage with things. It grows strong by pushing. Then the body has to be nourished. It has to receive material nourishment from the world, and in this way, digest it and incorporate it for the vigor, health, and development of the body. Now, the soul, the spirit, is just the same. It comes into reality in a nascent form. It comes into reality not fully developed. But its nourishment is not material nourishment. Its nourishment is meaning. So we must engage with meaning. We must take meaning to ourselves. We must intellectually digest it. And we must incorporate it into our spiritual, soulful structure. And in this way, the soul, the spirit, builds up, develops, and matures through time. Now, notice what's happening here is a kind of dialogue with the world. We're out in the world, struck by awe before its wonder. Questions are arising, and we're seeking deeper and deeper knowledge. And by their doing, we are forming ourselves. We are growing, developing, maturing. We are becoming healthier, stronger, more vibrant, more vital. This is the opposite of listlessness. This is the opposite of anxiety. This is the opposite of depression. This is what is the antidote to the suffering consequent upon evil that we inevitably meet in life. This is the answer to the chaos and confusion of life. But it requires something of us. It requires this engagement. It requires this focus, this attention. Now, this is to approach it from a kind of theoretical perspective, like as if we're spectators before the world, encountering things and absorbing it into ourselves and making it one with ourselves. But we're not just spectators. We're not just theoreticians. Rather, we're practically engaged in the world. Now, meaning comes to the foreground most forcefully for us in life through our practical engagement. Now, there's one clear idea that captures this for us. We are beings destined toward the future. We are searching for the true good. We're ultimately searching for the truth that is the supreme good. And this is the aim of our life. We're aiming toward the future. A simple reflection on time will capture this readily. What's the first thing that time teaches you? That you are to look forward, not backward. Just like walking, you don't typically walk backward. Time flows in one direction, it flows forward. We're forward-facing beings. We're moving toward the future. That means we're actively engaged with reality. What does this active engagement imply? It implies our own creativity. Not only are we theoretically before this wondrous world, but we're engaged and intended to be creative in it. And when you engage with reality like this, out of your own creativity, this is when life really takes on a vigorous, vibrant, and vital character. A simple way to capture this in an image is we're arrows, and we have a destiny. And we must bring that destiny before ourselves so as to aim correctly and achieve our function as arrows. This is to say we're end-oriented beings, or technically, teleological. Now, it is answering this why that brings life into its proper focus. And this is an incredibly important thing. If we don't move toward the future, aiming for something, we will be stalled in the present, listless with malaise, experiencing boredom, ennui, perhaps depression and anxiety. We will find ourselves stalled, and this stall won't just be like stopped in place, our development will be stalled. And life doesn't permit being stalled in this way, and consequently problems enter in. Therefore, it's of utmost importance, having attended to reality and discovered that it gives itself to you, that you then orient yourself with respect to it. Aim at something in it. Now, I spoke about that aim in the abstract a moment ago. We're aiming towards the true, we're aiming towards the true good, and we're ultimately aiming towards that truth that is the supreme good. Now, this is a generality, but this generality grounds down in each of our lives. Do each of us aim towards what is true? Does the truth coordinate us with respect to what is good? Do we look for surface goods that are shallow, or do we attempt to attain deeper goods that are more fulsome, more weighty, and more meaningful? The progress of life ought to be, as human, towards that which contains depth, because it only will fulfill if we adequately furnish our lives with this depth dimension. If I look at the world as shallow, I would experience myself as shallow. If I try to discover the depth of the world, I will discover there's an inner depth in myself, and life will be vibrant and meaningful. Okay, two parts, theoretical, practical. But then we have the question, how do we do this? How do we do this? What capacitates us to see the world clearly and precisely? What capacitates us to pick out something in the future that we're aiming at, and what will coordinate everything downstream from it, or I should say upstream from it? In the tradition, what coordinates us are simply called habits. Now, habit as a word is a funny word because we've taken this really weighty word and we've made it quite small. Like, I have a bad habit. I chew gum and I stick it under my desk. I don't actually, but I don't want to tell you my actual bad habits. But we all have bad habits. But we tend to think about the word habit in that respect. It's like some kind of clique of character. That's not great, but I do it. So I'm going to take you through an exercise for a moment to think about how significant habits are for life. What is human nature capable of? Well, to see what human nature is naturally capable of, just look at what a baby is when it's first born. What is a human baby capable of doing when it's first born?
Crying.
Breathing. And breathing. Suckling. But very little else. Okay? How does a baby reach your maturity? Not just by physiological processes, but the baby has this fundamental innate striving. Any of you who have hung around with children for any length of time whatsoever, see in the child, this child is just striving. And what are they doing? They're trying to articulate their limbs first. Like a baby is kind of funny when it's first born. It tries to move its arm and it hits itself in the head. It's not actually funny, but it's kind of funny, yeah? Isn't it strange not to be able to move your arm? But the baby just tries and tries again. It repeats the action again and again and again, and it gradually begins to get it. And when it gets it, it repeats it again and again, and then it leaves it alone. It has that habit. So to be able to articulate your limbs, and consequently to use your hands and to walk, that's not of human nature, simply speaking. That's human nature habituated out of this basic striving. And without it, we'd all be lying on the ground, unable to articulate any of our limbs. We develop these habits very, very young, so we don't even remember. Let's think of another, more complex. It's human to talk, yeah? Not really. We learn how to talk, just like we learn how to move our limbs and learn how to walk. How do we learn? Well, we hear what's around us, and we try to repeat what's happening, and gradually we learn to articulate meaning together with conventional sounds. Now, lots going on intellectually in doing that. You're putting together meaning with sound, and then you're trying to articulate your mouth, your tongue, your teeth. Like, think of each letter. Think of the difference between T and D. What your mouth has to do to articulate this differentiation, a really subtle movement. I had trouble saying my oars when I was a kid. I still do. It's actually a difficult movement to articulate. But as a baby, you have to learn all this by trying and failing, trying and failing, trying and failing, eventually kind of getting it and repeating it through time. And so walking, moving, talking, thinking, these are all habits. Now what habits are doing then is they're making us powerful. Yeah? What habits are doing is they're putting parts of our behavior in the rearview mirror. Let's take a habit that we all remember. At some stage, you learned how to tie your shoes. Yeah? Do you remember the first time? It was really difficult to articulate these limbs, put the laces together, and you had to really, really concentrate. And then you did it maybe like 5 or 7 times, somewhat successfully. And then after you did that, you're able to forget about it. You're able to just think, tie shoelaces, and then think about something else while you're doing it. Notice what habit is doing. It's leaving something behind powerfully, so it empowers you to be free to do something greater. That's the function of habits. Habits empower us to do things we weren't able to do so that we can put them in our rearview mirror and become more powerful. Now, all of our maturation, that's not merely bodily physiological, has this habituation baked into it. Now, I put before you tonight, having reached adulthood, you have all of the basic human habits already at hand. But does that mean then you stop in your development? No, all of this power to live an ordinary human life is to capacitate you for something higher. And then when you habituate that higher, you're capacitated for something higher. And when you habituate that higher, you're capacitated for something higher. And what this is doing at each strata is it's making you more powerful, making you more human. What does that mean? It's making you more creative. It's strengthening your aim at the future so you can actually achieve what you aim at. So we have three parts then here at play. We have the world is meaningful and we stand before it struck with awe. But we're not mere spectators, we're engaged in reality. We're engaged in reality because we aim at things. If we didn't aim at things, we'd never do anything. The aims we take before us are our purposes. How do we accomplish our purposes? Well, we grow stronger by habituating ourselves and gradually moving forward. And then when we achieve that purpose, we aim for something higher. When we achieve that purpose, we aim for something higher. And this is, in fact, what capacitates us, ultimately, to aim for the greatest height, to aim for their truth, that is, the supreme good, God. Now, notice, if we reverse this, we can't possibly begin to aim at God in a coherent and cogent way if we haven't begun to aim in these minor ways. If we haven't taken the world before us as meaningful, if we haven't taken objectives, if we haven't accomplished them, if we haven't done all of this preliminary work in what just lies before us, we can't seek that which is higher. And this is why in the Gospels, Christ says, if your virtue is like that of the Pharisees and scribes, that is, if you don't have virtue, there is no place for you in the kingdom of heaven. What he's teaching us here is that the habituation that is called virtue, that helps us aim at the truth about the good, this is necessary for human life. This is necessary for human maturity. Now, I would wager that if you take all this seriously, and this begins to become part of your life, which it probably already is to some degree, then you discover reality really meaningful. It will really manifest itself to you. The outlines of things will become clearer and clearer and more precise. Your aiming will become more and more precise. Your aiming will become more and more higher. And because of that, your life will be experienced by you as weightier, having greater depth and density. And it is then when we experience life like this, that life really begins to take off. Life really becomes meaningful for us. Now, it is a great pity, as far as I understand it, that this is not given to us as members of Western civilization. Because this, what I've put before you tonight, is the patrimony of the West with respect to human life in a foundational way. This is what you'll find in all the great thinkers from Plato, Aristotle, through Augustine, through Aquinas, up to the contemporary age. This is our inheritance. This is our cultural inheritance. But we live at a moment in history that has deconstructed this cultural inheritance. Indeed, deconstruction is a philosophical movement, and unfortunately also began in France. France has many good things. I don't dislike France. If I lived in France, I would definitely be this size because of the baked goods there. But they have bestowed upon the West something problematic also. They'll forgive me for saying. So, we have attempted, because of the great suffering of the 20th century, to divest the reality of its meaningfulness. This takes shape in existentialism, which becomes nihilism, which becomes absurdism. Because of this cultural product, we breathe this polluted air, and we don't receive the inheritance that is meant to be given to us. And consequently, we find ourselves at university, 20 years old, full of bodily vitality, but unable to encounter the real depth of reality, finding the world confusing because it is to some degree chaotic before us. However, there is an antidote. The antidote is not distant from you, it is found in you. It is found in your power to attend to the world, ask what things are, what you are yourself, ask who you are and who's around you, and ask why things are. And if you apply that power to your experience of reality, it will manifest its truth to you. And out of its truth, it will manifest its goodness. And things will appear before you, motivating your choice. You'll still be free before them, but should you choose them, you'll be habituated to be stronger, and in that habituation, you become more powerful. And then the world becomes more vibrant, vital before you. Now, up to this point, I've spoken mainly in generalities. However, this grounds down in our life also with a particularity. There's personal aspects to this meaningfulness of the world. This is best captured by a 20th century author called Viktor Frankl. He wrote a famous book called Man's Search for Meaning. He was a psychology student who just completed his doctoral studies in psychology, and then he was interred in a concentration camp, a series of concentration camps in the Second World War. After his time, he survived, he wrote a book recounting his experiences. And he had a unique aspect upon it because of a psychological formation. And in that book, in this most existentially difficult environment, a concentration camp, where all truth and goodness was attempted to be eroded by the Nazi socialist regime, even to the point of taking away their proper names and branding them with a number, trying to destroy what it meant to be human, taking away their freedom of movement, taking away their freedom of nourishment, taking away their freedom of creativity, all this taken away. Viktor Frankl recognized that one freedom remained, the freedom to face the world as meaningful, the freedom to discover meaning in the world, and this meaning that is discovered is an orientation toward the future. Now, Frankl noticed something really interesting about that. When a concentration camp inmate lost their sense of meaning, typically they would die very shortly afterward. Now, notice here, they didn't die first and foremost because of the lack of nourishment, the hard work, and the brutish behavior. This they were able to face if they saw the world as meaningful. But this they were definitely not able to face if they lost their sense of meaning, and with that, the sense of their own dignity. Typically, the men in the concentration camp would then stop shaving. Now, when they shaved, they didn't have razors, Mach 3 and shaving foam. They shaved with broken pieces of glass in ice-cold water. But they did this because they wanted to assert they had dignity in the face of the world, and it was meaningful, notwithstanding these awful circumstances. However, and it's understandable, I don't judge them because of it, if they lost their sense of meaning, they would lose the sense of their own dignity, they would stop shaving, and within a few days die. Now, what Frankl puts before us in that book is that meaning is not only something general, but rather is something particular. Meaning is something for you to discover that has a personal face. Maybe your meaning is some great cultural product. Maybe your meaning is some love, the love of your beloved, and with her or him, your family. Maybe your meaning is dot, dot, dot. But there is some meaning to the world that does or ought to grip your heart. And it's of utmost importance that you find that meaning, that you discover that meaning for yourself. Because in this, you discover your destiny, that is, what you could and should be aiming at. And when this grips you, like many of you might know here today, then you're really gripped and oriented in life toward the future. Then you can deal with suffering and the chaos it introduces and any sense of meaninglessness. Then you can orient everything around you with respect to that. And then you can really begin to move forward in life. So, before each of you, there is a destiny. God is definitely a being who has destined the human for himself with a generality. But God is also incredibly particular. He counts all of the hairs on our heads. Surely he has a sense of what your life is about. Now, you will never discover that particular meaning if you don't recognize that the world is meaning, if you don't aim, if you don't grow in the habit of virtue so you become more powerful, you will never discover it. And it seems to me that this is the malaise, the listlessness, the ennui of our contemporary culture. Because our orientation toward meaning has been deconstructed, we're left in a wasteland, and we're left without this capacity to orient ourselves. And we just go with the flow. If we do so, inevitably, problems will fill the void. And we will discover, in the end, that we will have encountered a meaningless world. We will have let ourselves encounter it as just meaningless. But it just isn't. Before the talk tonight, I went out to the outside just to look at nature. So let's end with some practical examples. How do you grow again your sense of wonder? How do you grow again your sense of meaning? Well, one key way is friendship. If you're really attentive to your friend, they become way more interesting and your friendship really deepens. If you really attend to the cultural products of the West, like its great literature, its great music, its great art, its great dance, this feeds the soul. If you really attend to the natural world and you don't remain sealed in the product of human life, buildings, then you again discover its meaningfulness. So these ordinary human things, these help us to experience the world again as wonderful, which we all want to do. Of course, also prayer. There is no better way to foster, to cultivate our wonder than being struck by the wonder of God who is brought before us in prayer. And probably I have spoken enough now. So I give the remainder of our time, I don't know how much time we have, over to your own questions and interests. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.